From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what will the ground war be like? We talk with Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. We also look at the environmental hazards of the war with the science advisor to King Hussein of Jordan, Dr. Abdullah Tukan. Comic Jimmy Tingle talks with us about writing new material about the war. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about Sigmund Freud and one of his most controversial case studies. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush conferred today with his top military advisors and said that he'll hold off ordering a ground assault on Iraqi forces. The president met with Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and General Colin Powell, who returned last night from consultations with the top commanders in the Persian Gulf. The president emerged to say that the air campaign against Iraq has been very effective and it will continue for a while. Officials at the Central Command in Saudi Arabia said today that 2,900 sorties were flown against targets in Iraq and Kuwait. They said that almost 63,000 missions have been flown since the war began. NPR's Deborah Amos describes the preparations underway on the ground along the Saudi border with Kuwait in a report cleared by U.S. military censors.
In the distance, you can see the smoke of the Wafra oil field still burning, and the tanks here are about 50 meters apart. These are Saudis on the front line. Kuwait is right in the distance, and you can hear the occasional rumble of artillery fire. At this time of night, there are no planes flying over, although the Saudis say that they can hear them every night, and they can see the flashes in the dark. This is Deborah Amos on the border of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi officials said today that there were some slight injuries in Riyadh from the debris of an intercepted Iraqi Scud missile. The Scud was reportedly hit by Patriot missiles at around 10:30 local time. Witnesses said the Scud and at least one Patriot exploded in a fireball in the sky, and debris hit a university campus outside Riyadh. Officials said an Indian and an Egyptian worker on the campus were injured by glass fragments. The Bush administration is increasingly concerned that reports of Iraqi civilian casualties are helping Saddam Hussein win the propaganda war against the coalition forces. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the U.S. acknowledges there have been some civilian casualties as a result of Allied bombing raids, and while it has no information on the extent of the damage, it does not believe Iraqi government figures. Nevertheless, Fitzwater said the propaganda and PR battle is where Saddam is scoring his points. And he said, it is disturbing to find this evidence that somebody's buying it. The spokesman was referring to comments made by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, who criticized the coalition for going beyond the UN mandate to get Iraq out of Kuwait. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Air raid sirens have been reported again in Israel just a little more than 7 hours since a Scud missile was reported to have struck in the central part of the country. Radio broadcasts urged Israelis to take shelter in sealed rooms. There was no damage or casualties reported from the earlier attack. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 71 points to close at 2,902. Advances led declines by a margin of 14-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The trial of South African anti-apartheid activist Winnie Mandela was adjourned today when prosecutors said a key witness had been abducted. Mrs. Mandela and three co-defendants pleaded not guilty to charges of kidnapping and assault. The trial was adjourned for the day when prosecutors said that one of the surviving victims, a key prosecution witness, had disappeared. A federal grand jury has indicted the Detroit chief of police in connection with the disappearance of $2.5 million from a secret fund set up to finance undercover police operations. Don Gagne of Michigan Public Radio reports.
Federal authorities have handed down two separate indictments, one against 15-year police chief William Hart, the other against Kenneth Weiner, a former civilian deputy chief of the Detroit Police Department. According to U.S. Attorney Stephen Markman, between 1986 and 88, checks totaling $1.3 million were drawn on the secret police fund and issued to phony businesses set up by Weiner. Markman says that fund was controlled by Chief Hart.
Mr. Hart is also charged in a separate count with the theft or embezzlement of as much as $1.3 million of other funds of the Secret Service Fund. It is alleged that he obtained these funds and converted them to his own use through checks drawn on the fund and made payable to cash.
Chief Hart has not commented on either the indictment or calls for him to step down pending the outcome of legal proceedings against him. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Officials at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana are looking for anyone who may have been exposed to two students who died from a blood infection. A 19-year-old sophomore died of the illness on Saturday, and a second 19-year-old victim died this morning. Officials say the infection is caused by the same bacteria that causes meningitis. They want to locate anyone who was in contact with the two victims so they can be given antibiotics. Doctors said that patients can usually be successfully treated if they're diagnosed early. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I spent most of last week in bed with the flu, waiting for my voice to return. It's good to be back, and if you're at home with the flu today, I hope you feel better soon. Well, President Bush has just been briefed by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell on the best timing for a ground war in the Gulf, and it appears ground fighting is still a couple of weeks away. Our first guest today, Admiral Eugene Carroll, says that if and when ground fighting does get started, it's likely to change our impressions about the war. Carroll was a naval aviator during the Korean War. He commanded the aircraft carrier the USS Midway during Vietnam, and he was the first naval officer to direct military operations for all U.S. forces in Europe and in the Middle East. Now retired from the military, Carroll is the deputy director of the Center for Defense Information. He spoke with producer Pat Ford.
What do you think the Cheney-Powell trip to Saudi Arabia accomplished? What was on their mind when they went over there?
They went to receive firsthand, face-to-face information and advice from General Schwarzkopf and his senior staff as to the state of readiness of our forces to move into a ground war. They got that impression in a very short time. 48 hours doesn't enable you to evaluate the state of readiness of a half a million men and women under arms, but I'm sure they feel more current and more confident in their appraisal of the situation today.
And what do you think they're telling the president, and what should he be asking them?
Two factors here. One is purely military, and I hope that Secretary Cheney and General Powell are advising solely with reference to the military factors. That could be two-pronged. One, we can use more time to increase the readiness of some of the people who recently arrived in the theater and get the equipment that just arrived a week or so ago moved forward and ready for combat. Two, we've got to look ahead at the weather pattern and recognize the longer we wait, the more we're going to be concerned about combat dragging on into the summer period. And I'm sure that from a military standpoint, General Schwarzkopf doesn't want his troops fighting out there in 130-degree temperatures.
What could more bombing accomplish at this point, since there's already been such extensive bombing?
Well, that's another element of the military equation. If the bombing is continuing to inflict substantial damage on the forces, on Iraqi forces, cutting into their supplies, cutting into their equipment, then you reduce the amount of resistance that you may encounter once the land war phase starts. In other words, you take away tanks and artillery, you take away supplies, and that weakens the ability of the Iraqi forces to defend against our attack.
But it seems that for so many bombing sorties over the past few weeks, really relatively little damage has been done, given the power that's been unleashed on the countries.
I believe the perception that the war was going very, very well in the air was heightened and perhaps even fostered as a deliberate policy of the administration to convince the American public that we're really doing well. It's a clean war, a sanitary war, almost a benign war in which we attack and destroy only military targets, and every bomb hits the target. Every bomb hits what we aim it at. At least that's the impression I get from these briefings, because I have yet to see them display a foot of film in which we've missed a target. Now, I'm an aviator, a military aviator who's dropped an awful lot of bombs in his day, and I want you to know that with any weapon, you will hit some targets and you will miss some targets. In a fairly recent briefing, General Schwarzkopf pointed out our campaign against the bridges, which are essential to the lines of communication leading to Kuwait. And he said we had attacked 33 of them with 790 sorties. And then he said, let's roll that tape. They proceeded to show a series of either three or four bombs, each one hitting a bridge directly, a direct crushing blow at the bridge. Mm-hmm. And then that was the end of that explanation of how the war was going. Well, I did some arithmetic. 790 attacks against 33 bridges figures out 24 attacks per bridge, and they weren't all down yet. If every bomb hits a target, why do we have to go back 24 times and more times even after that? The answer is that there are an awful lot of these weapons, smart and dumb bombs, that do not hit what they're aimed at or are aimed at the wrong target. And as a result, when they start showing us films in Riyadh of bombs missing target, I'll have a lot more confidence that we're seeing what war really looks like. We probably are only 10 to 20% into their combat capability at this stage, if that much. And believe me, it has been a very successful air campaign to date. It's just that the American public has expected too much of it because they've been coached by the White House to expect too much.
Admiral Eugene Carroll is my guest. He's the deputy director of the Center for Defense Information. What does it mean that the Republican Guard in Iraq is dug in? I know in Vietnam it was a literal term. The Viet Cong were in tunnels underground, but I wouldn't imagine that would be possible in the desert.
It's not possible to dig in to the depth that you could achieve in many places in Vietnam, but they still are well protected against anything except direct hits in their gun emplacements, in their tank shelters, in their personnel shelters. They are below the surface. They do have camouflage. They do have sand berms, as they're called, built up around them, so that unless you get a bomb or a missile directly into that enclosure, all you're going to do is throw a lot of sand around. You're certainly going to shake them up. It's not very pleasant living under those circumstances, but the units, equipment, and the people survive. Probably 19 out of every 20 bombs that are dropped on their positions, because they don't hit directly on a prepared dug-in position.
We've already had a few casualties and some disturbing pictures of POWs on TV, but by and large, up till now, it's still been a very high-tech war, a sort of a Nintendo-type war. Once the ground war starts, is that phase over, or are there high-tech weapons that can be brought to bear in a ground war?
Well, let's talk about that in two ways. First, this has not been a high-tech war. A lot of the technology that's being used out there was developed 20 years ago. My ship, the USS Midway, the aircraft carrier, was built 45 years ago. I scarcely class her as a high-tech weapon. But the fact is that it is the weight of our effort that is producing the results, not the superior technology alone. Let me give one measure of that. Secretary Cheney said that the Iraqis were the fourth major military power in the world because they had spent $50 billion on armaments in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, the United States spent $2.6 trillion on armaments, or 50-plus times as much as the Iraqis. Who can doubt the outcome of a war between the United States of America and Iraq, when we have 50 times the weight of preparation in dollars, at least? So that the fact is we're overwhelming them with bombs, with artillery, with naval forces, and it's only when we have to go in on the ground that you really recognize the fact that this is a classic war, that people shoot people with artillery pieces, with machine guns, with mines and so on. And that's where the casualties are going to come. And you're right, the benign picture of this high-tech Nintendo contest that has been presented so often in these briefings is going to fade very rapidly. It will be a bloody, brutal war on the ground.
I've heard descriptions of some of the weapons that the Iraqis are likely to use as like gas-filled trenches that they could set on fire and tanks would explode and not be able to cross them, and barbed wire, and actually some of the lowest tech sort of techniques that you can imagine. Is that your reading of what a ground war would be like?
In the initial phases, if we go directly against their major strongholds, the heavy defenses they've built up in and around Kuwait, yes, it would be fighting through a series of very cleverly designed obstacles that try to force the advancing units to approach through certain avenues, what are called killing zones, and their weapons will be concentrated on those lines that they think we must follow. It's for this reason that I'm willing to speculate, at least, that the major U.S. attack will come well west of Kuwait, will be to the west of those heavy defenses, and will drive northward, cutting off Kuwait, cutting off their supplies through the Euphrates River Valley, and sealing those troops in Kuwait so that if they want to fight, they have to come out to fight. When they come out of these prepared fortifications, these tank traps and minefields and so on, then they are vulnerable to our artillery, our aircraft, and the battle will be fought on much more favorable terms for us. If they don't come out, they simply run out of supplies, and I suspect we would be capable of producing a total military victory over Iraqi forces north of Kuwait in 4 to 8 weeks, and force a political surrender as well as a military surrender.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll is the Deputy Director of the Center for Defense Information. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Pat Ford. Coming up, the environmental impact of the war. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Abdullah Toukan is the science advisor to the King of Jordan. Before the war started, he warned that a Gulf War could result in environmental catastrophe. Now he says those fears are turning to reality, but the worst may be yet to come. In a ground war, oil fields could be set on fire, leading to a chain reaction of fires, resulting in deadly chemicals being released into the air. Saddam Hussein is holding the environment hostage in this war. The U.S. military says he intentionally released oil into the Gulf from a Kuwaiti oil platform, creating the Gulf's largest and most devastating oil spill. Saddam Hussein is still threatening to set the oil fields of Kuwait on fire. I asked Dr. Toukan if he and other Middle East leaders were urging Saddam Hussein to not foul their own part of the world.
You know, Terry, we have, and they've heard us, obviously. But, let me tell you how the logic sort of presents itself then when, let's say, the answers I got back, okay? For instance, one answer is that the United States used oil as a weapon first, which is, now here I'm relaying to you the logic of an argument that was given to me.
By whom, by the way?
Oh, by them and by people closely associated with them, with Iraq.
Oh, by Iraqis?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that the oil weapon was used, and the United States and their allies used it first against us. And I said, which way? They said by an oil embargo in the beginning, before, during August, September, before the war broke out. And then the second thing they said is that, look at the refineries around Baghdad, they were destroyed. Most of the petrochemical industry in Iraq proper has been destroyed and has been bombed away. Then they said the first first oil spill leak, it started when they hit the two tankers. It wasn't us. So then the last thing they said, if they use it, then we want to use it as a defense as well. We will use everything possible. And the only answer is to plead, because I'm not here. I told them I'm not really in the position as a scientist, and I'm not there really to sit down and point the finger at anybody who started what at the moment. The point is the damage has been done. How do we avert any more and stop any more from being done? Because this won't do us any good. Militaristically speaking, it has a very minimal effect, even if you spill water and spill oil in the waters of the Gulf. That was my, let's say, appeal. The rest, really, it's not in our hands. It's the logic that is being presented to you. So we've tried to appeal to the United Nations of through their resources, is to talk also and to talk to all sides concerned as to how we can do something. We've really tried, and I have presented my studies there, not personally, obviously, but sent the studies over and pleaded with them all the way.
When Iraqis come back at you with the argument that, you know, the United States was the first to use oil as a weapon, what's your counter argument? How do you come back at them to defend the environment?
Well, you see, I come back to it in the old part and parcel of everything, of saying that, my friends, I am not here to even talk to you about the reasons of invading Kuwait or not, or the whole world wanting to implement United Nations resolutions from 660 on. I am here just to plead with you that take what we have said into consideration and the vulnerabilities. And by the way, they have a very, very strong scientific infrastructure, incidentally. These people have very good petroleum engineers and scientific institutes in Iraq. So they're very well educated scientists over there. And just conveyed our findings and pleaded with them that please take these into consideration. In addition to, we are always available here for anything we can do for innocent civilians that get in the way. There's no, you can't really transfer that into who did what or who blames who in this sense, you see? Because once I do that, then you lose the whole core and the whole point of the scientific argument or the humanitarian component of this. Then we might as well then flow into surface-to-surface missiles. They tell me, really, this is the kind of conversation I got into. Look at the Tomahawk missiles. Who fired them first into Baghdad on January the 16th or 17th morning, whenever it was? They did. So we shot out. You know, when you start getting into this, and then you would say, well, you said you will do this. And they said, well, I would have, but if they didn't. So I couldn't really get into that conversation. All I wanted to say was, you should know all this. Your calculations should show you all this. Please think very carefully. And we will try to convey this to the West as well, for them to think very carefully and everybody to be in standing by just in case there is an accident that happens between both of you, between two sides, so that we can bring in an international team and clean it up.
What kind of reports have you been hearing from people in different countries in the Middle East about the quality of the air and if that has been affected at all by the war so far?
Yeah, I've heard a few things in Iraq itself that there has been traces of nerve gas.
From the bombing of the nerve gas plants.
That's right, yes. You see, that's really so unfortunate. There are a number of things. If, as alleged by the United States, and the President of the United States has made a statement that the nuclear and the chemical capability of Iraq has been destroyed, we know Iraq has two research reactors. One less than 1 megawatt thermal and one 5 megawatt thermal. If the 5 megawatt thermal was hit and the core cracked or the core was destroyed, then there will be quite a bit of radiation in and around the facility, because it's a very highly enriched uranium reactor and it's been operating for 22 years. So the core itself will be radioactive, so in addition to the fuel element. So if there has been a seepage from the reactor, and with the meteorological conditions now, and there is wind, it could carry the radionuclides further away from the site. Who will be affected? The people there, and you've got the agricultural area, and you've got livestock. And what you have to worry about is obviously two things, iodine-131 and the cesium-137. We have no traces. We don't know really. In Jordan, we have not had actual reports or counts or anybody to report to us what the concentration amount is. But this, I'm telling you, as a worst case, if somebody tells me I have destroyed a reactor. The chemical plants, there is now controversy whether the milk plant that was bombed, was it a biological weapons facility that was producing anthrax, or was it a milk plant? You know, the worst thing you could ever do is to bomb a biological plant with anthrax, because that will just disperse all over the place, all over the region, stay in there for a while, and produce epidemics. And, you know, the anthrax has about an 80% lethality rate.
What would you like your role to be as a scientist and environmentalist during this war?
I would, my role, I would really like to put together an international environment crisis management team, and to start linking up with the specialists and the experts from outside, such that we continue our studies regarding the Gulf or any air pollution studies. But when all this is all over, we have focused enough attention so we can prioritize ourselves quickly and go and attack the problem quickly. Not to wait until the whole thing is over and then try to scramble people in and try to make assessments from the very beginning, and that takes a long period of time. And with time, we have more. The disaster has increased, and its effects has increased. That's one thing I would like to do, is put together an international environment crisis management team together, and also to continue this linkage with them, continue association with them, such that in the future, if there is any other crisis, the component of environment can be plugged into the very beginning of the decision-making process. Not, unfortunately, like now, 2 weeks before the decision was made for the war.
Dr. Abdullah Toukan is science advisor to King Hussein of Jordan. He spoke to us from his home in Amman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, a talk with comic Jimmy Tingle. Tingle does a lot of political humor, and he's written a lot of new material about the war, but he's not sure it's what people want to hear when they go out for an evening of entertainment. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the record we're listening to now, a 1961 reissue by tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that examines one of Sigmund Freud's best-known failures. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that the air war against Iraq will continue for a while before the next stage of fighting. Mr. Bush made that comment after meeting with U.S. Defense Secretary Cheney and General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Cheney and Powell are just back from a trip to the Persian Gulf. The president said that the Allied air effort has thus far been very effective and will continue for what he termed a while. PLO Chief Yasser Arafat arrived in Amman, Jordan today for talks there with King Hussein. NPR's John Burnett has this report.
This is the first visit to Jordan by the PLO chief since war broke out 26 days ago. Reuters news agency quoted PLO sources as saying that seven top PLO officials were in Baghdad over the weekend conferring with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz, the first such meeting since the war. Both Jordan and the PLO are supporting Iraq in the war because of its attempt to link the Gulf conflict and the Arab-Israeli problem. In other developments, about 100 Palestinians, including women and children, protested in Amman today over Israel's refusal to let them return to their homes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They complained that since Palestinians publicly supported Saddam Hussein in the war, Israel is trying to evict them from their homeland and make room for arriving Soviet Jews. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
Iraq has announced that it's lowering the age of mandatory military service. Officials in Baghdad said today that now all 17-year-olds will be drafted to serve in the army and have been ordered to report to military offices between Friday and March 20th or face legal action. Funeral services were held today in Utah for one of the 11 U.S. Marines killed during the first major ground battle of the Persian Gulf War. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
It was Dion Stevenson Day in Bountiful, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Flags flew at half-staff during an official day of mourning. Marine Lance Corporal Dion Stevenson died January 29th near the Saudi border town of Kafchi. The light-armored vehicle he rode in was hit by what military officials say was probably friendly fire. Family and friends remember the 22-year-old Marine enlistee at a funeral mass in a Salt Lake City cathedral. Among them was a younger brother, also a Marine, serving in Saudi Arabia. He says he wants to return to the war. An honor guard of Marines and Bountiful Police escorted the mourners to the Bountiful City Cemetery. Dion Stevenson was laid to rest with full military honors. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 71 points to close at 2,902.23 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Iraq continued its Scud missile attacks today, firing at both Israel and Saudi Arabia. Hours after the first attacks, another Scud missile was fired a short time ago at Israel. No reports yet of injuries or damage. Earlier today, a missile hit a desert site in the central part of Israel. Another missile aimed at Saudi Arabia was destroyed by two Patriot missiles, but debris from that explosion injured two people and caused damage to one building. According to Tehran Radio, millions of people in Iran took to the streets to mark the 12th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. President Rafsanjani criticized both sides in the Persian Gulf War, calling for an Iraqi pullout from Kuwait and for foreign forces to leave the area. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
Huge crowds converged on central Tehran, chanting anti-US and anti-Israeli slogans. Almost a ritual now, 12 years after the revolution toppled the Shah. For the first time ever, the Iranian leadership received a message of congratulations from Saddam Hussein, who said he looked forward to better relations between their two countries, united by their belief in Islam. But few Iranians forget how Saddam Hussein took advantage of the turmoil of the Islamic Revolution to attack Iran. There were many disabled veterans from the ensuing 8-year war at today's rallies. President Rafsanjani told the crowds neither side in this Gulf War was just. But his harshest words were for the U.S. He said the Allied air raids amounted to the destruction of the economic potential of Iraq and Kuwait, and bombing of residential areas was genocide. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Poland's largest automotive plant has stopped production until March 30th because of poor sales. The Polish news agency says that during this period, the workforce of some 10,000 will be on paid leave, although how much they will be paid was not revealed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up a little later on the show, the political humor of Jimmy Tingle. Nowadays, young jazz musicians under the age of 30 get all the attention in the mass media. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's easy to forget how many great older musicians are still around, like one of his favorites, Chicago-born tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan. Kevin has some thoughts about the relative merits of youth and maturity in jazz.
Jazz is often considered a game for young folks. They have the stamina, fast reflexes, and muscle tone the music calls for. But a lot of players get better as they get older. For some reason, that's especially true with tenor saxophonists. As they age, their sound gets deeper and more resonant, more barrel-chested, and their ballads get more worldly wise. You can hear that blossoming in players like Jimmy Heath and Benny Golson, in the last recordings by the late Bill Barron, and in Clifford Jordan. Jordan, who turns 60 this year, has a lyricism and grace that put him in the front rank of modern jazz musicians. He also has an incredibly pretty sound. Listen to his 1988 version of Alec Wilder's I'll Be Around, to my ears, one of the great jazz ballads of recent years. Here's a good chunk of it. That's from a session led by flugelhorn player Art Farmer called Blame It on My Youth. Clifford Jordan's tone is luminous, and he gets the most expressive effects with the vibrato he applies to the last note in a phrase. He uses vibrato like a punctuation mark. There's a well-seasoned aspect to his playing few young players get the hang of. It's something that comes with age. And yet, listen to what Jordan sounded like 30 years ago. That tune is Malice Towards None by Tom McIntosh from Clifford Jordan's album Bearcat, recorded in 1961 and 2. It's been reissued in Fantasy Records' OJC series. Like a lot of saxophonists in the early 60s, Clifford Jordan was dealing with the influence of John Coltrane. Even so, you can hear that Jordan's mature style was already developing, if not fully formed. At age 30, he had the same carefully tailored vibrato, the same doleful cry of the blues, and the same way of booting out swinging phrases at brisk tempos that he has now. He had a great band on the album Bearcat, including pianist Cedar Walton, someone he still plays with once in a while, and drummer J.C. Moses. On a blues called Outhouse, check out the way the drummer puts heavy accents on unexpected beats. Oh, and don't miss Jordan's nod to Ravel's Bolero. Nobody plays the drums like that anymore. People would think it was clunky. But J.C. Moses gets a lot of credit for how fresh this music sounds, much fresher than the hard bop young musicians play now. Players may improve with age, but musical styles most always sound better when they're young. Hard bop records from the 50s and early 60s, like Bearcat, have a reckless quality their modern counterparts don't have. That's because back then, the players were still testing the music's limits and their own, and they weren't ruling anything out. After all, there's something to be said for youthful brashness and inexperience.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the reissue of Clifford Jordan's Bearcat album on Fantasy Records. This is Fresh Air. War is no laughing matter, so the people who make a living by making others laugh are caught in a tricky situation in wartime. Comedian Jimmy Tingle has become known for his political humor, and he's writing new material about the war. He told me he thinks we have a sanitized picture of the war.
G.I. Joe dolls, happy little dolls going off into battle. Why don't they ever show the reality of these dolls, you know? I mean, there's nobody walking around Saudi Arabia with big smiles on their faces going into battle. Show the reality. If they showed a G.I. Joe in a wheelchair, nobody would buy it. And if they showed a G.I. Joe doll, or if they showed the destruction that a B-52 bomb does in Iraq or any place else in the world, people wouldn't buy it, in my opinion.
Now, what are some of the things that you're up against as a comic trying to deal with the war in your material, but not knowing who's in the audience when when you get up on stage?
Right. Well, you know, you try to be as fair as possible. I mean, first of all, I qualify everything by saying, you know, look, I support the troops, and I support their families, of course. I mean, it could be anybody over there. And, you know, we're trying to prevent the loss of life on all sides, you know, Iraqi, American, Egyptian, Israeli, whatever. And so I just, you know, that's basically where I'm coming from. And a lot of people are very confused about it. And there's no black and white issues, I don't think, here. So I'm trying to learn about it as I go along also. It's a learning experience to me.
Now, you performed over the weekend, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where were you?
I was in Pensacola, Florida, the University of West Florida. And I was at Roanoke, Virginia.
Try out anything new?
I think so. I don't know. This is all new. I haven't been on stage that much since the war started. I've only worked about four or five times. So I did a couple of shows here in New York that where the war was the theme. So that material, you know, you could... They understood why they were there, and they understood where I was coming from with the material. Whereas in Florida and Virginia, they're just students at a comedy show, and they've been in class all day. And, they, you know, you start to get to the war, it's like, oh, no, not another lecture.
Oh, so you found that there was resistance to dealing with it.
Well, you know, they just, they're listening. They're listening, yeah. I think a lot of people in general are just, they turn on the television and they're bombarded with it, you know, excuse the pun, but they've, you know, it's shoved down their throats. I mean, it's on the news for the last 6 months, every day. And so they go to a comedy show and they're trying to get away from that. But I think that they appreciate at least addressing the issues on stage and trying to show the ironies involved.
So what's been going over really well with your audiences?
Well, concerning the war, not a great deal, actually. Not a great deal. If I was up there going, and nuke Iraq and bomb Hussein, there would probably be a lot of people cheering in the audience. That's not what I do. I've approached it from a totally different angle. I was in Scotland when this started. I was working at the Edinburgh Arts Festival in Scotland, and I was going through the papers there, you know, and before I got there, I was hoping for some things to, going through the papers, trying to find some subjects we'd all have in common. I never expected a war, you see. I was looking for something a little lighter, you know, maybe a scandal, you know. And over there, there was a lot of mixed emotions, you know. There's a lot of mixed emotions everywhere you go. People have, I don't want to be forced to joke about, you know, people getting killed and people's relatives over there. And that's not what I want to do.
Have you been watching a lot of TV?
yes and no. I try to, and then I just get so, you know, I get taken back by it. I just don't feel like watching it. So I watched a few things on CNN, and I was thinking, you know, I was looking at the films of Iraqi people demonstrating. They had big pictures of Saddam Hussein and sort of billboard pictures of him everywhere you went. And I was saying, wow, well, what do we worship in this country? I mean, what do our billboards say? You know, the Marlboro Man, Spuds McKenzie, play the lottery, drive a big car, and eventually you'll have sex, smoke, drink, drive, gamble, and eventually you'll find love. Well, I always felt sorry for this guy who actually believed in the billboard gods. You know, some 65-year-old compulsive gambling alcoholic with emphysema walking around a nursing home with lung cancer and a walker going, "Where are the girls? Where are the girls? I followed all the directions. Where are the girls?" So what are we worshiping?
What was the first gig that you had after the war started?
The first gig after the war started was I did a thing for, Comic Strip Live. I did it up in Boston. And it was the night that Tel Aviv got bombed, and it was like a horrible night. And it's just a weird, I don't feel like doing comedy. You know, it's like this. I don't feel like talking about anything except the war. But I don't feel like even doing that, if you know what I mean. But that's my job. It's my job, and that's what I have to address. And so, you have to make people laugh, and, you know, it's got to be funny. But I'm very much torn, but I just don't want to be misinterpreted.
Is this the first time that you've really had to sit down and ask yourself what your job as a comic should be in time of a national trauma? I mean, war is always traumatic.
Yes, it is. It's my first war also. In Vietnam, I was like 12, and I was yelling at people, "Why don't you get a job instead of protest?" You know, I don't know. And the protesters, they say, and, you know, protesters are hurting the war effort. I don't know. I mean, dissent is a part of democracy. And, you know, I heard one guy say, Robert Novak, I think it was, that these people protesting are professional marchers. And when I took that term, professional marchers, I started to think, you know, I think people who never ask questions, who never get involved, who never look beyond the headlines, I think those people are the real professional marchers.
Jimmy, I'm going to change the subject on you for a minute.
Alrighty.
Before we started the interview, you told me that you were going to be doing a one-man show in the near future, and I thought,
oh no, Jimmy Tingle isn't going to be doing like Jimmy Tingle does Truman. I mean, you're not going to be doing like a great president or a great poet in this one-man show, are you?
No. Good, I'm doing myself. I'm doing The Education of an American Comic, and it's basically a lot of it's how I got started. You know, there he goes with that you know again. A lot of it will be just how I started and the experience that shaped my life and how I see the world and where we're going from here. And, you know, just basically, I'm trying to figure it out as I go along, Terry. I'm not an expert. I don't pretend to be an expert. I'm not a military analyst. I'm a comic. I comment on what's going on in the world. I read the papers. I try to keep up. Sometimes I don't know what to believe. And so that's what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to get at the truth somehow.
What are you most confused about right now where you don't know what to say about it because you don't even know what you think of it?
I don't know what to believe. I don't know how much of it is slanted. I don't know how much of it is truth and how much of it is propaganda. People are very upset about the reporters. Peter Arnett, that's his name, right?
Yeah, from
Peter
CNN.
Arnett and
yeah.
CNN saying he's a tool of the Iraqi propagandists. Well, you know, people don't get upset about hearing the propaganda on this side of the world. You know, I don't know what to believe, actually.
I guess one thing that's difficult for a political comic that a lot of other comics don't have to face is that your material gets out of date. And
yes.
You have to really keep up in a way that if you're just talking about relationships, you don't have to keep up that way.
Right. Right. Unless you go through a lot of relationships.
Well, it's a good point. Jimmy Tingle, thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Jimmy Tingle has a comedy special that will premiere on HBO on April 6th. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Updates from the Pentagon and from military briefers in Saudi Arabia about the war against Iraq and the Persian Gulf. Also, John Barry, defense correspondent for Newsweek magazine, talks with us about possible changes in Allied strategy that could include an early assault on Kuwait City. I'll talk with an Iraqi-American in the Detroit area. He says he's trying to build bridges between the Iraqi community and the rest of the world. Danny Zwerdling talks with us about events in Liberia. He's just been to the capital city, Monrovia. And some lost music of Charlie Parker, the Benedetti tapes recorded years ago in nightclubs.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ever since Sigmund Freud's theories about the human psyche were first published, social scientists and critics have had scores of theories of their own about Freud's life and work. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book about Freud and one of his patients, which examines how the outside world affected their inner one.
There's a musical that's running now in Vienna that I'm dying to see if it ever makes it to Broadway. It's called Freudiana, a musical about psychoanalysis. Freud's famous patients, like the Rat Man and the Wolf Man, suddenly break into song, and his collection of Greek figurines mutate into a giant chorus line. The score features neurotic numbers like Let Yourself Go, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and Funny You Should Say That. Whoever the writers of Freudiana are, they have a few loose noodles in their strudels. Still, I'd be curious to see how they portray Dora. She was the 18-year-old woman who came to Freud in 1900, suffering from hysteria. She suddenly left his treatment 11 weeks later. The case haunted Freud. It was his first significant failure, and it's become the subject of almost violent debate. Early supporters of Freud saw Dora as just another manipulative female, using her sickness to get attention. More recently, feminist critics have championed Dora as a victim of Freud's misogyny. Certainly Freud's technique seemed almost brutal. He interrogated Dora mercilessly about her sexual fantasies. Janet Malcolm compares the case to an account of an operation being performed on a fully awake patient. Now, a book by historian Hannah Decker entitled Freud, Dora, and Vienna, 1900, sheds more light on the case by examining the world that existed outside Freud's consulting room. Decker's discussion is refreshing because, unlike a lot of other feminist scholars, she doesn't blame Freud for not transcending the sexist attitudes of his time. Instead, Decker starts out from the Freudian premise that society makes us sick, and she investigates how their society harmed both Dora and Freud. Decker says that for a Jewish woman like Dora, it's hard to tell whether anti-Semitism or misogyny was more ruinous. Vienna in the late 19th century was a city where Jews were still arrested under suspicion of murdering Christian children in religious rituals. If bigotry wasn't enough to warp Dora's self-image, consider her society's patronizing attitude toward women. Hysteria was common. Decker suggests that women fainted and lost their voices because they were taking to extremes the passive female ideal of their time. Freud actually treated Dora gently compared to other physicians who applied hot irons to the spines of their hysterical patients. But Decker points out that the Freud who saw Dora had a few problems of his own. His marriage had cooled off, and he was passed over for academic promotion because he was a Jew. Freud badly mishandled Dora's case, in part because the anti-Semitism and sexism of 19th century Vienna damaged him, too. He concluded, for instance, that Dora was abnormal because she didn't enjoy the sexual advances of a family friend. Decker suggests that Freud identified with this friend and that he was unconsciously aroused by Dora. Decker's book is part sociology, part posthumous analysis of Freud and Dora. It also contributes to current arguments about the infallibility of psychoanalysis by reminding us that even Freud was a victim of his historical circumstances.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Freud, Dora, and Vienna, 1900, by Hannah S. Decker. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Audie Voblitis, Thad Kirk, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, economist Robert Kuttner analyzes how the recession, the savings and loan crisis, and the war will affect the American economy. Also, we meet actress Blair Brown, the star of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.